In Titus chapter 2, as Paul was giving instructions to that young preacher about the things he was to preach, he told him to speak the things which are fitting for sound doctrine. And then he went category by category with age as to what that might look like. In verse 3, the older women, he said, likewise are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips, nor enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good, so that they may encourage or train the young women to love their husbands, to love their children. Is it really necessary to be trained to love your husband? Or to love your wife? Or to love your children? Evidently so, because the apostle said Titus was to preach in such a way that the women would do that. We're not talking simply about the fact that we ought to love our family members, but maybe more particularly, how do you do that? What does that look like on a day-to-day basis if we love one another in our homes the way that we ought to do that? That's our lesson for this morning, to think about love in our homes. And I'm going to take us this morning simply to one text, to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, where the apostle talks to the church at Corinth about love. This is a familiar paragraph to you, 1 Corinthians 13, beginning in verse 4. In the context, the apostle is telling the Corinthians what love looks like in a local church. How people will behave toward one another in a congregation who genuinely love one another. That said, the church is kind of a big family. And I think we can take these same characteristics that the apostle suggests in this paragraph and think about them in our homes. And so for our lesson this morning, I'm just going to go through these and give you a thought or two that I have about each one of them as to how they might fit. And then you can think more about each one of these characteristics of love that the apostle talks about. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 4. First of all, the apostle says, love is patient. Love doesn't blow up at someone very readily. The word that the apostle uses here literally means long-tempered, opposite of our short-tempered that we use. And so the idea is that people who act lovingly toward one another in the home are self-restrained and self-controlled and won't react strongly and violently to people. There are so many homes that are just so devastated by violence within them. The proverb said, a soft answer or a gentle answer turns away wrath. You remember that? And that is so true. And not only are we patient in terms of reactions to things, I would also suggest that patience goes to our communication with one another in the home as well. We're patient listeners. We hear each other out. We hear in order to try to fully understand where someone else is coming from and don't just cut them off because we're not liking what we're hearing. Love is patient. And then the apostle says, love is kind. It speaks kindly, gently, one to another. It practices basic courtesy of please and thank you. Sandy is so good about this in our home, of remembering to say thank you for little mundane things that have to be done, but when I do them, she says, thanks for doing that. Love is kind. And love also finds acts of kindness to do for one another. Things that will just brighten somebody's day. Things that will just encourage them a little bit along the way. Things that were actually helpful to one another. Let me do that for you. Let me help you with that. We do that because it's an expression of kindness, and that's what love is. Love is patient, and love is kind. And the text says that love is not jealous. When kids are growing up together, there tends to be a kind of a rivalry between them very often. Occasionally we get a little jealous of one another. Maybe one of the brothers is particularly good at sports, or maybe one of the sisters is particularly academically outstanding, or whatever it is. So there's a little rivalry that goes on. But the fact of the matter is that love ultimately is not jealous because some other family member does something a little better. Quite the opposite. We're actually kind of glad about that. We're happy for them that they have things in which they excel, and we're supportive and encouraging of them in that. Occasionally, especially when a husband and wife's relationship is not exactly all it needs to be, husbands and wives can get in a bit of a rivalry for the attention of the children, for the affection of the children. You want them to love daddy best, or you want them to love mama best. And so there's a little jealousy between husbands and wives. I've seen this with grandparents, too, vying for the attention of the grandchildren. Love isn't that way. Love is benevolent. It's not jealous. Willing to share. Another time when this comes into play sometimes around holiday time. You know, your children marry, and then they have the grandchildren. And you expect them to come to your house at the holidays all the time. You forget that they married into another family, and that family expects them to be at their house all the time, too. And some families have major problems over this because people are jealous and not willing to share. Love's not that way, is it? The apostle says love is not jealous. And then he says, love does not brag. There's something that you're better at than your wife is? Some of us might have to search a while for that. The wife might think there's something she's better at than the husband. But we don't have to make a point about that just because there's something that we're a little better at than someone else. We don't want to try to make someone else feel bad about that, because that's how we perceive it to be. That's a kind of an arrogance on our part, which is indeed the next thing he says. It's kind of hard to talk about one of these things without the other one. But love doesn't make a point of some perceived benefit. Love's also careful about how much it brags about the family itself. You know, Your grandchildren are just the cutest grandchildren ever were. And you know that, don't you? And mine are too. And I know that. And sometimes we get so carried away boasting about our children and what they've accomplished, or our grandchildren, it almost makes others kind of resentful toward them because we're singing their praises all the time. We're a little careful about that. And this braggadociousness goes to arrogance. I tell you, every once in a while, there's a husband that you can't tell him anything. He's got all the answers. He knows everything. And that makes life pretty miserable for everybody else in the family. Or another aspect of arrogance is an unwillingness to admit it when we've done wrong. And don't say it just in the sense of, well, I'm not perfect, I know, but nobody's perfect. No, say, I messed up there. I did the wrong thing there. Be genuine about confronting your own weaknesses, and don't be arrogant and puffed up and haughty about that. And Paul's word here literally means inflated. It's puffed up. One of the translations put these two things together and said, don't be puffed up and don't be a windbag. And that's how love should behave. What else the apostle said? Verse 5. Love does not act unbecomingly. Your translation may say something like, love does not act rudely, or love is not rude. Several of the translations use the word rude in this place. From my study of the word, that's possible, but everywhere else this word or forms of this word are used in the New Testament, the idea of rudeness is not really the idea. It's the idea of shameful conduct. It's the idea of conduct that is often associated with things that are considered shameful by society, as well as maybe those things that are considered shameful by the Lord. And the apostle is saying that if we love one another, and we're making family applications, if we love our family members as we should, we won't behave in such a way as to bring shame or embarrassment to the family. You know, our conduct affects other people. Sometimes we lose sight of that a little bit, and we get to thinking that somehow, well, I can just kind of go out and do what I want and it's not going to make a difference. It has very real effects on our family members. And we need to have enough regard for them if we don't have enough regard for ourselves to stay away from such conduct. Love doesn't act in unbecoming ways. Love doesn't act in such a way as to embarrass the family, nor to publicize family problems in such a way that would bring an embarrassment. And I want to speak plainly on this one point. Hear me clearly. If you're having some sort of problem in your family, husband and a wife, or whatever it is, Facebook is not the venue for addressing that problem. Don't put it out there. That's acting unbecomingly. That's a problem in and of itself, in addition to whatever problem. Love doesn't do that. Love does not seek its own. It's not self-centered. It's not self-focused. We've got one assignment on this particular requirement. You'll have to take some time to think about it. Think about the circumstances in your home when you and your wife, or you and your children, you and your parents have some difference of preference. Different way to spend the money, different place to eat, different thing to do, different whatever. How often do things get settled the way you would like them to go? And how often do they end up going the way someone else would like them to go? And you'll take an inventory of that. Might be a little eye-opener to whether we're seeking our own or not. Love does not seek its own. And the text says, love is not provoked. It's not easily provoked. J.B. Phillips' translation of this, he said, love is not touchy. And I like that. Somebody that wears their feelings on their sleeves, and it just doesn't take anything to set them off. And love is not that way. Love learns how to take things in stride. Love knows how to put up with the idiosyncrasies that family members have. We all have our little things, okay? Our little unique characteristics of how we do things or how we look at things that to your spouse just make no sense whatsoever. Okay? And you just have to learn to deal with that and put up with it and don't make a big thing about it and don't make a point of it all the time. Just deal with it. And don't get upset about that. Conversely, not only is love not easily provoked, but love itself is also not a provoker. It's not one that pushes the buttons, because you know this will set them off. It's not one that harps and nags on little things that aren't going to get any better anytime soon, because that just creates friction. Love doesn't want any part of any of that. New American Standard says in the last expression of verse 5 that love does not take into account a wrong suffered. I'm using on the chart the New International Version of that expression. Love keeps no record of wrongs. It's an accounting word that Paul used, the same word that he uses over in Romans, where he talks about our faith being credited to righteousness. It's the idea of a bookkeeper. And his point is that if we are loving toward one another, we're not sitting down with a bookkeeper making mental notes of all those times when she said this or when he did this. Why do people do that? Seems to me people do that for one of two reasons. Either, number one, they're trying to build a case in their minds for how bad this person is, or they're saving that up and then they use that later on as a kind of a defense, a self-justification when I've done something wrong. Well, now I did that, but I say, you remember the time you did such and such and such and such and such? And doesn't make me look so bad in my own mind that way. This disposition is exactly opposite of forgiveness. And the Bible teaches us to be forgiving people. Love does not keep a record of wrongs. Verse 6. Love does not rejoice in unrighteousness. Unrighteousness is quite simple. That's just what's not right. And so, a family who practices love is not going to have family members that get involved in things that are not right. And if some family member does get involved in what's not right, and what's right or what's not right is determined by God's Word, we're not going to defend that. We're certainly not going to support them in those things that are not right. We're not going to make excuses for. And if what they get involved in is that's not right is not a moral question, maybe it's a religious thing, and they get involved religiously in practices that aren't right. We're not going to try to defend that and make excuses for that and be accepting of that. Love doesn't rejoice in unrighteousness. Love rejoices with the truth, the apostle. We love the truth of God's Word. And so it is the standard by which all family decisions are first and foremost based. A lot of things to consider at times, but the first thing is always going to be, what does God say about it? Because we love the truth. And if we love the truth in our families, we are going to study the truth. We're going to listen to the truth. And we are going to live the truth. And then the apostle concludes in verse 7 with a group of four positive statements. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Bears all things could be rendered, love covers all things. That word sometimes has that meaning. And it's the idea of someone who is helpful toward another in helping to cover or bear. Remember Galatians 6 and verse 2, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. That's what we do in a family. We bear one another's burdens. We bear with one another and we help to shoulder those loads and to be supportive of people. Because as families, we're well aware of the challenges that each other face. We want to be helpful any way we can. Love believes all things. First of all, of course, we believe the truth, but Paul's point in this context is not so much about that as it is of believing in people. And we believe in one another. We want to be optimistic toward one another, and therefore we're helpful toward one another. And when we see a problem, we don't just give up and say, well, that's a lost cause. We buckle down and say, we've got to do whatever it takes to fix this problem because we're believing it's going to get better. We're going to improve. We're going to make it. And toward that end, we go to work on problems. One of the problems that we have sometimes in marriages particularly is a husband and wife will they'll start to develop a bad habit and that'll kind of grow over time and this problem will grow and get worse and worse. And by the time this couple goes to seek some help, we've got some pretty entrenched attitudes and behaviors here that are hard to unroot. Don't wait so long to get some help when things aren't going just real smoothly. Look for some answers. Look for some help. Love hopes all things. Can't help but be optimistic. It looks forward to the future. It sees brightness. And it works to try to bring those things about. And love endures all things as well. It endures all the challenges that the various family members face. And we're going to go through some. Might add that it also endures prosperity, because that in and of itself can be a real challenge to us if we're not careful. It endures time and aging and changing relationships. When a husband and wife come to the point in life when the last child is left and we've got the empty nest, as we call it, a different kind of a circumstance that you've dealt with for the last 20 or 25 years or however long it's been that you've been rearing the children. Love just... That's a time when some couples start having problems. Love endures that, endures all the circumstances. And as we grow older and we're less capable and more dependent, love just keeps right on going. It even endures when death invades the family. Love persists because it's the nature of love in our homes. And that's our lesson for this morning. There's so much for us to do, to work on, to practice love in our homes. I'm going to conclude this morning's session with verse number 3 from the song "Where Love Is in Our Home." So we'll sing this verse and then we'll be dismissed.